I'm wondering where I'm going to fit along that spectrum. Some of you may find this paper to be far too scholastic for your taste. Some of you will undoubtedly find it too philosophical and analytical. And so maybe I have begun by successfully offending everyone, which may or may not be beneficial. But anyway, in a paper that I read at the Sunstone Conference 2 years ago, I noted the fact that LDS contributions in the area of Christian ethics were few and far between, and they have not really improved much since then. As a result, the development of theoretical categories of Christian ethics has limited input from LDS thought in that area. The usual theoretical lines are drawn between Catholic natural law theory, which is generally classified to be teleological, and divine command theory, which is classified normally as deontological. To broaden the ethical spectrum of debate, we have views ranging from humanistic to Christian theories. The question is, where does LDS theology find its place in this moral continuum? 2 years ago, I maintained that a theistic humanism, which valued both the existence of God and human happiness, should have a place on this ethical continuum. Within the space of this category, which this category could occupy, I also identified a subcategory called Christian eudaimonism, in which I maintained that LDS theology has an ethical link which is fundamentally teleological. This category is not within the auspices of either natural law theory or divine command or voluntaristic theory. It stands as a rival theory of Christian ethics. With this in mind, the question becomes what, if anything, in LDS theology allows it to be morally classified as both Christian eudaimonism and teleological. To accomplish this, I propose to examine various theological doctrines and situations which, if allowed to speak for themselves, rather than reinterpreting them to fit preconceived moral categories, that's a bite against the Kantians, I'm sure you'll see that, will show their fundamental grounding in a telos or a teleology. Before any doctrines or situations are discussed, let me point to issues that may seem trivial to an LDS person with no background in comparative theology. First, the moral classification of LDS theology into a category of Christian eudaimonism presupposes that Mormon theology is Christian. But not all theologians classify us as such. As an undergraduate, I attended a Protestant college which had a religion requirement of one course, which I faithfully took. The instructor promptly defined Christianity as a religion in which salvation was received by grace through faith in Christ. The principle of good works of merit was an abomination and unchristian. In my zeal, I attacked this definition in class and in examinations to the demise of my grade point average. I came away with a C in the course. It is not uncommon in the world of theology to use or misuse Paul's writings to a very exclusive definition of Christianity. I use the term Christian in a more generic sense to refer to a belief that Jesus was the Son of God and the Savior of the human race. Thus, LDS theology is Christian in the generic sense, regardless of the particulars surrounding how salvation comes. Secondly, eudaimonism, which is the Greek word for happiness, may elicit more thoughts towards Athens than to Jerusalem. It is common knowledge that the LDS Church encourages its members to embrace truth wherever it is found, and I personally believe that philosophy is a discipline where truth as well as falsehood can be found. In fact, I have an affinity with a modified form of Aristotle's definition, which reads, "Happiness is an agreeable feeling produced by activity in accord with virtue." Along with this, I personally have an altruistic view that the aim of right action is the happiness and the well-being of others. The LDS affirmation of happiness is well known and not exactly typical of much of Christian theology. After spending 5 years in the southern United States, I'm quite familiar with people laboring under religious doctrines that eschew human happiness, sometimes to the emotional detriment of those people. Thus, Christian eudaimonism as a moral category would be considered unchristian by some, and LDS theology as an example of this moral category would be unacceptable to others. With this lack of unanimity in theological thought, let me move ahead to an examination of doctrinal passages within the LDS standard works that require, in my view, a teleological interpretation. By teleology, or telos, I refer to a theory of purpose, ends, goals, and the end term of a process. The moral telos is the view that the ultimate standard of human life is value, such as happiness, which would encompass the concepts of well-being and the general welfare. The primacy of happiness, or joy, is usually pointed to in the Book of Mormon, 2 Nephi, chapter 2, verse 25, with the declaration that men are that they might have joy. And I might add that that word men also includes women. If the word exist were substituted for the word are in the passage, which can be done without any loss of meaning, then the very existence of people and their mortal creation is for their possession of this feeling called happiness. It is profound that no other such item, such as service or celestial marriage, is mentioned as a purpose for existence. This leads us to refer to happiness as an intrinsic goodness or something good in and of itself, whereas other elements of the doctrine, such as principles and ordinances, can be referred to as extrinsic goods, all implemented or revealed by God to assist in promoting the happiness of his children. There are many other passages by old and contemporary authorities expounding on happiness as a telos. In the Book of Mormon, Helaman chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, we read, "Yea, we can see that the Lord in his great infinite goodness doth bless and prosper those who put their trust in him. Yea, and in fine doing all things for the welfare and happiness of his people." Also from the Book of Mormon, 13th chapter of Helaman, verse 38. "And ye have sought for happiness in doing iniquity, which thing is contrary to the nature of that righteousness which is in our great and eternal head." Also from Neil Maxwell, in an article entitled "Eternalism versus Secularism" in the Ensign in October of 74, I quote, "The adventure of orthodoxy consists, therefore, of having eternal principles fitly framed together so as to reduce human misery and to facilitate human happiness." There are obviously many passages of like nature, and in analyzing these few, it is plain that happiness is the end promoted by God, sought after by humanity, and had by righteous rather than iniquitous living. Here, right action, or virtuous action are aimed towards and produce happiness. God does all things, including each and every commandment, fitly framed together to reduce misery and promote the welfare and happiness of his children. In addition, consider the Lord's counsel to Frederick G. Williams when he was called to be a counselor in the First Presidency of the Church. In the Doctrine and Covenants, section 81, verse 3 and 4, the Lord told him that if he was faithful in counsel, prayerful, and a missionary, which are virtuous actions, that, and I quote, "in doing these things thou wilt do the greatest good unto thy fellow beings, and will promote the glory of him who is your Lord. End quote. Here the principle of maximization of the greatest good is clear, and the greatest good is clear. This maximization principle may sound utilitarian and offensive to some, but the scriptural language, again, is clear. This is also not a classically utilitarian doctrine. The method by which the greatest good is achieved is by obedience to the Lord's counsels, which includes all the commandments. The rule of happiness is clear. It is obedience to a wise and loving God. This rule, however, does not mitigate the fact that the fundamental basis of this morality is teleological, and that the achievement of this telos is by obedience to the rules that are set. Here God issues commands because they are right when judged by promotion of happiness. Commands are not right solely because God commands them, as God has told us why he commands what he does, which reason is the maximization of the greatest good. When, in the world of LDS thought, it is said that whatever God requires is right, or do what is right, let the consequence follow, it means that we have faith in God's judgment of maximization of happiness. The concept of rightness, then, entails the promotion of joy. The LDS person does not have commands as guides to all actions in all situations. The well-known scripture suggesting this reads from the Doctrine and Covenants, section 58, verse 26, "For behold, it is not meet that I command in all things. For he that is compelled in all things, the same is a slothful and not a wise servant." With this in mind, the search is on for general principles to guide one's actions. From the counsel given to Frederick G. Williams, we may well conclude that two general principles can be found in commands. But the intent of the above scripture is to allow for some freedom of decision rather than have a separate command for every small and minute action. The moral notion of promoting the greatest good is no secret in LDS thought. If this sounds like some form of utilitarianism, then so be it. Rules of one type or another are not without a place in some utilitarian theories, but a thorough evaluation of whether or not rules or commands can be consistently maintained in any utilitarian theory would require another paper. But a brief consideration of justice is required before an examination of the explanatory power of this teleological theory of LDS ethics. Justice has historically been considered by many thinkers to be the critical problem for classical utilitarian theory. Their basic argument is that a pure rational calculation to maximize societal benefits leads to actions that are offensive to our notion of justice. Hence, slavery and other abrogations of civil rights may be justified under the guise of the greatest good promoted. I agree with this argument, but these same thinkers often go on to claim that rules and any teleological theory are incompatible, which is certainly not clear to me. Hence, these thinkers usually opt for a deontological moral theory, which means that the aim of right action is not entirely dependent on happiness or other values, and that an action may be known to be right without a consideration of the goodness of anything. Thus, some Christian thinkers opt for divine command or voluntaristic moral theories with commands rather than happiness as the ultimate standard. In this view, commands are right solely because God commands them, with absolutely no consideration of the happiness produced. Justice must be accounted for in rule utilitarian theory. And it should be plain by now that I believe that there are enough similarities between it being rule utilitarian theory, and a Christian eudaimonism to have arguments for and against one to impact the other. William Frankena claims in one fell swoop to dismiss all forms of ethical thought based on the principle of utility or happiness, ranging from John Stuart Mill to Richard Brandt and any like Christian theory, by claiming that promoting goodness does not necessarily tell us how to distribute in society that goodness. Therefore, distributive justice is a separate principle that most would desire to include in a moral theory. Of the defenses against this charge, Brandt's is closest to a defense that I would take as a Christian teleologist. His position is that distributive justice itself is a rule which would maximize utility or happiness. Frankena counters by saying that this simply cannot be shown to be a fact. Two points are worthy of consideration in establishing distributive justice as a fact or a rule of happiness. First, distributive justice entails judgment as well as the distribution of goods and services. As LDS people, we are told that God's judgment will be distributed to all mortals, and given the fact that we are training on earth to become as God is, the concept of distributive judgment is necessarily entailed in a view of justice. These and other conditions are described by Alma in the Book of Mormon as the great plan of happiness. Secondly, the concept of love for others contains many conditions for fulfillment, ranging from service to honesty. Consider the law of consecration and the United Order. Surely, the moral concept of love here entails a condition of distributiveness in relation to goods and services. It is well known that this type of society would have no poor among them. To summarize this defense of distributive justice as a fact or rule of happiness, let me rephrase part of the 11th chapter of the 41st, 11th verse of the 41st chapter of Alma to read that living consistently with the nature of God implies that we are in a state consistent to the nature of happiness. Alma goes on in the 14th verse to expound to his son Corianton on the moral law which produces the ultimate reward of happiness. And I quote, "Therefore, my son, see that you are merciful unto your brethren. Deal justly. Judge righteously and do good continually, and if we do all these things, then shall ye receive your reward." The adequacy of any theory is measured to a degree by its explanatory power. A moral theory must be able to explain the various ethical situations that people find themselves in. One famous biblical situation is Abraham's intent to sacrifice his son Isaac at the Lord's command in Genesis chapter 22. LDS commentary on this situation usually revolves around two explanations. The first is that Abraham's obedience was being tested. The second is that the intended sacrifice was a typification or typology of God's sacrifice of his son. But from a moral point of view, the interesting point is Abraham's dilemma in facing God's commands, which are contradictory. A command to sacrifice a son is not consistent with commands to love children and refrain from taking innocent life. Philip Quinn constructs the logic of the dilemma in the following manner. God commands Abraham to kill Isaac. Abraham, therefore, ought to kill Isaac. And secondly, one ought not to kill an innocent child. Isaac is an innocent child. Abraham ought not to kill Isaac. In Fear and Trembling, Soren Kierkegaard strongly criticizes the interpretation that Abraham really did not have to sacrifice Isaac and that God did not actually command human sacrifice, thus causing the moral dilemma. For Kierkegaard, God did in fact command the death of Isaac, and Abraham fully intended to carry it out. Abraham agonized over this for days. Of the interpretation that this experience was only a trial for Abraham, Kierkegaard says in Fear and Trembling, "People construe the story of Abraham in another way. They extol God's grace in bestowing Isaac upon him again. The whole thing was only a trial." A trial, that word may say much or little, and yet the whole thing is over as quickly as it is said. One mounts a winged horse, the same instant one is at Mount Moriah, the same instant one sees the ram. One forgets that Abraham rode only upon an ass which walks slowly along the road. And he had a journey of 3 days, that he needed some time to cleave the wood, to bind Isaac, and to sharpen the knife. Abraham did not know during these travels that God would spare Isaac. If we agree with Kierkegaard and say at least that the moral dilemma was a significant part of the story, then how can an LDS moral theory explain it? Joseph Smith taught the following, and I quote, "God said, thou shalt not kill. At another time he said, thou shalt utterly destroy. This is the principle on which the government of heaven is conducted, by revelation adapted to the circumstances in which the children of the kingdom are placed. Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is." This is fully consistent, in my view, with the Doctrine and Covenants in section 56, verse 4, which says, I quote, "Wherefore I, the Lord, command and revoke, as it seemeth me good," end quote. Consider also Joseph's teaching, which is, I quote, "That which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another," end quote. The critics claim that these reversals in commands show an inconsistent and capricious God unworthy of worship. But the strength of the LDS position is that God commands or alters the commands, and I quote, "as seemeth God good," end quote, according to the circumstances of his children. This is revolutionary in theology because God again tells us of the criteria he uses in commanding. The supreme good or joy and circumstances could vary widely. This teleological view again shows happiness as the aim of right action and as the primary criterion for moral decision making, if we are to become as God is. Assuming that Abraham was aware of the gospel as a plan of happiness, then his decision to obey God and kill Isaac was based on faith that God's commands promote the greatest good. Here, duty to God's commands means duty to happiness. With this interpretation, the most profound departure from Kierkegaard's view is the implicit rejection of a Kantian universalizability as a necessary condition for the terms moral and ethical to be applied to rules. There is no teleological suspension of the ethical. Rather, Abraham's situation was a teleological extension of the ethical. God's puzzling command to kill Isaac was not intended to be universalized to all humanity. Yet it remains moral given the criteria of the greatest good and the circumstances. This eliminates the need for Kierkegaard's conclusion that duty to some non-moral and religious values transcend duty to the ethical. This does not mean that LDS theology is a moral free-for-all. Rather, it recognizes the applicability of commands to all people with exceptions, which remain moral based on certain criteria. It is well to remember verse 6 of section 1 of the Doctrine and Covenants, quote, "Behold, this is mine authority and the authority of my servants, and my preface into the book of my commandments, which I have given unto them to publish unto you, O inhabitants of the earth." End quote. The fact is that the doctrine rejects the rigid universalizability criterion as a rule to be moral. Another situation that has caused some puzzlement is Nephi's killing of Laban in the Book of Mormon, in 1 Nephi, chapter 4. After several honest and unsuccessful attempts to secure the brass plates containing the genealogy and the law, Nephi encountered a drunken Laban in Jerusalem. In verse 10, Nephi describes his initial reaction to God's command to kill Laban in order to obtain the plates. Quote, "And it came to pass that I was constrained by the Spirit that I should kill Laban. But I said in my heart, never at any time have I shed the blood of man, and I shrunk, and would that I might not slay him." End quote. He was commanded twice more with no results. Then the Lord reasoned with Nephi in the following manner, verse 13, quote, "Behold, the Lord slayeth the wicked to bring forth his righteous purposes. It is better that one man should perish than a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief." Here is a prime example of the reasoning of God in changing commands. The reasoning is based on the greatest good for the greatest number. The killing of Laban was a moral act based on this calculation. Remember that unbelief is equated with unhappiness. Again, there is a teleological extension of the law. But before he kills Laban, Nephi reasons with himself as to why Laban should die, which reasoning reduces to the fact that their posterity must have a written record of the law of Moses. He concludes his own reasoning by saying in verse 18, quote, "Therefore I did obey the voice of the Spirit, and took Laban by the hair of the head, and I smote off his head with his own sword." The story goes on, however, as Nephi adorned himself with Laban's clothes to deceive his servants, his meaning Laban's servants, and thus obtain the plates. There is no doubt that if Nephi had been caught in the act of killing Laban, he would have been convicted of murder in Jerusalem. I have often wondered if Nephi would have been under condemnation from God if he had convinced himself through his own reasoning. I don't know the answer. Possibly a direct command is necessary to amend the law. Yet, if a distraught neighbor ran into my home claiming that her husband was trying to kill her, and moments later that husband was at my door with a knife in his hand, I would not be rigidly truthful and tell him that she was in the next room, nor would I wait for a command from heaven. In discussing this ethical situation concerning Nephi and Laban, Jeffrey Holland, in the Ensign, September 76, points out that the necessity to obey commands and the necessity of their posterity to have the records. Holland's emphasis on obedience to the lawgiver, even though the law may change, is similar to the trial interpretation of Abraham's dilemma, which interpretation Kierkegaard was strongly critical of. However, his analysis does point out that nothing seems to have conditioned Nephi to deal with the moral dilemma that he faced. What is missing in Holland's analysis is an in-depth look at the values used by God to reason with and convince Nephi that Laban ought to be killed. Remember, it was not till after the Lord reasoned and explained his actions that Nephi actually committed the act. As I mentioned earlier, it is essential to understand that Nephi did not simply respond to a command. Rather, the Lord reasoned with him, and he reasoned with him in addition to being commanded, reasoned with himself in addition to being commanded. The profound moral revelation is the last sentence and the culmination of God's reasoning in verse 13. Quote, "It is better that one man should perish than a nation should dwindle and perish in unbelief." Clearly, God's pattern for moral reasoning is the greatest good for the greatest number, a pattern which LDS people are charged with emulating as the rational basis for commands, in my opinion. This in no way obliterates obedience to the lawgiver. Rather, it enlightens us to the necessary connection between a theory of value and a theory of obligation, a connection which is teleological. As a postscript in Nephi's situation, let me add that I have heard the situation explained, in terms of Lawrence Kohlberg's stages of moral development. This argument is that Nephi and the ancients operated at a lower stage than contemporary people do. In reviewing Kohlberg's stages, the best I can make out of this argument is that the ancients were at stage 5, which valued life in relation to community welfare as well as a right. But contemporary folks are at stage 6, which valued human life as sacred and representing a universal value of respect for the individual. If we accept this argument, then we are saying that our morality is superior to the ancients, and that from our perspective, the killing of Laban would be an immoral act. I have argued that this is wrong in favor of rejecting the rigid universalizability criterion for designating something as moral. In addition, Larry Jensen, in an unpublished paper, lists a host of arguments against Kohlberg's stage theory, which can be summarized as weak data for such sweeping conclusions as people going through stages in a preset order, and each higher stage being superior to the lower stage. To conclude this paper, I have tried to carve out a moral classification called Christian Eudaimonism, with LDS theology as the or an example. I care little about the title of the category, but I care greatly about the existence of the category as a rival theory in the spectrum of Christian ethics. The time is long overdue for the conjunction of happiness and commands, which actually strengthens faith and obedience to commands by understanding in greater detail that God issues commands because they are right. It may seem strange to some to see such a mixture of religious and philosophical names, ideas, and arguments. But the purity I am after is truth, which crosses disciplines of knowledge. It is well to remember a First Presidency statement in the LDS Church on February 15, 1978, regarding moral truth. Quote, "The great leaders of the world, such as Muhammad, Confucius, and the reformers, as well as philosophers, including Socrates, Plato, and others, received a portion of God's light. Moral truths were given to them by God to enlighten whole nations and to bring a higher level of understanding to individuals." End quote. John Stuart Mill exemplifies the others when he says that, quote, "If it be a true belief that God desires above all things the happiness of his creatures, and that this was his purpose in their creation, utility is not only not a godless doctrine, but more profoundly religious than any other." Thank you.